So I wanted to share today about these three complexes that we talk about and we practice with and we try to liberate ourselves from in Buddhism.
It's the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex.
It's the way we almost live our lives and separate ourselves and judge each other and put each other into categories and put ourselves into categories. And in any one moment, we're either floating in a complex of inferiority, a complex of superiority, or a complex of equality in any one moment in time. Just like this, as the mind moves, the complex that we are holding ourselves in moves. And it continues like that. So we're sort of caught in this, these complexes. So I wanted to read a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh. This is a reason for the computer. Sorry about that. And the phone, you know, it's a recording. It's like, it can't get past the technology. Okay. So someone had asked Thich Nhat Hanh at a retreat about this, the suffering from the complex of inferiority. And his response was, in the teachings of the Buddha, low self-esteem causes suffering and sickness, but high self-esteem also causes suffering and sickness. You think that you are too important, that you are superior to others, that creates suffering. And even if you think that you are equal, that is also a kind of sickness, because the complex of equality is also wrong thinking. I am not inferior to him, I am his equal. There is still comparison between two selves. Comparing and feeling separate is why there is a feeling of superiority, inferiority, or equality. So the practice of Buddhism is to look deeply, to see that the other person is in you and you are in the other person. You are not separate, you inter are. You are them and they are you. That is the only way to abolish these three kinds of complexes. So in our world of seeking justice and activism, and however you describe yourself as an activist, there's so many shades of activism. Sometimes I think just being in the world and negotiating and navigating in the world is a work of activism, because it's so structured to be oppressive sometimes. So just getting up in the morning and deciding to take that first step, that can be like one of the biggest activism that you will ever do every day, is to keep getting up. And then there's the maybe the other kind of activism that we might think of when we see the uprisings like we had in Baltimore, where we rise up and we march and we stand up to the oppressive regimes, like unfair policing in Baltimore, and not just in Baltimore, that oppress black and brown bodies at will, or court systems that don't bring justice, or the wars that are ongoing, or the fight against immigrants, or the way we treat females, the misogyny and the patriarchy that exists in every single one person. The way we hold people in poverty as separate from us. When we see them on the street, we want to offer help, but we offer help often from a place that we're better than, we're lucky, so we can offer help because I'm not them, I'm different. And so it's an act of kindness, but it also may be an act of kindness that comes out of a complex of superiority, feeling I am still separate from that person. And the teaching, the depth of the teaching, is that we have to remove ourselves from that perception that we're separate in order to really be able to offer kindness from a place of heart that's non-separate. So in our activist spaces, I find it even more critical to become aware of how we practice with superiority and inferiority, and how we justify demonizing people in power because they make us feel inferior, right? So there's this undercurrent that we justify our belief in separating ourselves from people who are we perceive as oppressive, and who indeed are oppressive, right? We have a current presidency that is certainly oppressive, right? In many policies and behaviors and speech. And then there's a way that because of that outward show of power that is violent and oppresses so many people, that that there's a way that we feel that we can demonize them because they're so separate from us. That's something that we would never do. We would never do that. And it doesn't mean that we don't challenge, that we don't hold accountable, that we don't change, that we don't, even that we don't put our lives on the line. We put our lives on the line to change the regimes that are oppressing us. And some of us do it every day, some of us do it in different ways, but we keep doing it. So it doesn't mean that we don't do the work of change. It's just, where in our heart are we coming from when we are about change? Do we see the target as someone separate from us, that we can demonize them because of their actions? Are we still able to remember that the person is actually no different than us? It's just that, and it's not a little just, it's a big just. It's just that person happened to come into the world with a certain karma, with a certain effect from their previous life, and be exposed to an environment that has also watered and nourished certain ideologies, certain ways of thinking, certain perceptions that allowed them to feel superior and to demonize those and to perceive them and project them as inferior, right? But it doesn't mean that they're any different than we are. And it doesn't mean we don't stop them, right? And I think this is where in Buddhism, sometimes when we talk about us Buddhists being nonviolent, for some reason we think that means that we can't fight. But that is not so. There is so much to change in this society, in this world. I mean, we wouldn't be here today if we didn't feel that there was something very deep that we are aspiring to change. And maybe some of us feel and realize that in order to make that outward change, that we have to make the inward change. Maybe we haven't reconciled that yet. Maybe that's still like, yeah, whatever, I need to go out there and march, and I need to implement policy, and I need to join this group and do that. I need to put my body on the line. Maybe we're still thinking that change comes from that outward being and doing. So we might be anywhere in this process of how we see change. And some of us may feel that activism and change is, like I said, I know my mom often says, it's a miracle I got up this morning. And that's real, right? Because I think when we've had challenging lives, it's a miracle to get up in the morning and face the world again. Because maybe you're habituated and you've been habitually exposed to many challenges. So just to get up in the morning and face that world again, it's an act of activism, right? It's like we are engaging and we're saying we're going to, just by being who we are and stepping into that fray, we are saying that it is about change. So how do we really start in our circles of activism, whatever they look like, whether we're organizing from the base, or whether we're doing policy work, or however we are providing services? How do we act toward change and justice and love in action without holding ourselves as a separate entity from whoever it is that we're engaging with. And the invitation today actually is when you leave and you continue to do your work, to try to notice how that you are holding yourself separate when you see someone that you're helping. Because part of what allows us to help sometimes is that we do feel that we are separate from that. Look how lucky I am. That could be me. Right? And that's fine if we see that that is me. There is a way that that is me already. It is not that could be me. It's already me. But we've learned to, and maybe it's to survive, maybe it's a way to create superficial boundaries to allow us to engage. You know, maybe we use these ways, these separate ways of moving through the world, we dissociate from the connections we have with each other. Maybe we do that in order to be able to be with. So these complexes of superiority or inferiority, these ones are usually more easy for folks to get. You know, it's like, yeah, this person feels they're superior to me. You know, as a Afro-Latina, I know a lot of white people, majority of white people that I engage with think they're better than me. That's on them. I can't help them with that. I mean, that's their perception and that's the way they move in the world. So that's that superiority complex. And so for many years, I believed that. So I adapted, inculcated, embedded, imprinted, acted out of that inferiority complex. I am inferior to whiteness. Many years. It's one of the reasons I went, and there's many reasons I went to school and for higher education. But so one of them was that if I get all that education that all those white rich people have, then I will be just like them. I spent a lot of years with that inferiority complex. And then I did, and then for some reason they still treated me like I was stupid. And then I was like, whoa, like, okay, that didn't work. Yeah, and we all do it in different ways. We all do it in different ways. We all hold stories and we buy into the social construction, this fabricated society that has lifted up certain groups into power and certain groups without power. You know, that's kind of the nutshell of the superiority inferiority complexes. It's like, who has in the society, you know, we can name them off, right? Race, gender, sexual orientation, class, immigrant status, language, body, able-bodied, health, size, body size, spirituality, who we worship, who we don't. And there's others, right? And that's the regime that we are in. There's a fabricated society, and if you are in, according to race, if you're in the white supremacist area, then you're superior, and if you're not, inferior. If you're male or male-identified, you're superior, and if you're not, you're inferior. And like that, each one of those have their superior-inferiority designations. So those ones are easy, and also every one of us steps in that every day, right? Like one of the guidelines is that we are, with every step in that we take, we are holding multiple identities at one time, right? A black male is walking within that inferiority complex of being black, right? But at the same time, he's walking in that complex of maleness, and that's acted out on. All right, we've got lots of misogyny in our POC community. It's rampant, especially in social justice spaces. All right, and I'm telling you that because that's what I continue to experience in those spaces. But it's always been like that as long as I've been engaged in activism. So those things still exist. So we are intersectional. our identities, it's not one. It's not we hold power because we're white. No. White females, you know, they're walking without that power as a female identified person, right? So at any one moment, we are holding all those identities and we're negotiating all those worlds. And what we do is we often put it into the superior and inferior framework, and we live into those identities, just like I lived into my identity, because I fall into a lot of those inferior, right? Designating an inferior, non-powered structural status. So it's really easy to really sleep there, nap there, wake up there. Yeah. And those of you who hold those multiple identities, you know what I'm talking about. Right? Because we're all still healing. I'm still healing from that. But it's the equality complex, right, that a lot of us that fall into either one of the superior or inferior, the equality complex is the one we all grasp for. We're like, if it was equal, it would all be fine. But the equality complex still comes from this idea that there's two separate things. But if we each had the same thing, these two separate entities, then it would be okay. So do you see that it still comes from a conception and a holding of two separate things? Because it's sometimes hard, right? Because in social justice, we talk about equality. Now we talk more about equity, right? But but we the discourse, it's been equality. And you know, equal rights, human rights, equal rights, right? And so we really embody this idea that if we all were, if they had the same thing, if I had the same thing they had, then it would all be okay. But you see, it's still them and us. You see that? It still comes from two separate identities, right? And the teaching, the Buddhist teachings, which is deep and healing, is that it's the same us. There is no separation. So I drew this because I think it helps sometimes to get it. So maybe if you think about balance, right? So I'll stand up here. So if this is like the cosmos or the world or just Baltimore, or just this room, here, the inferiority complex would be, there's this part here, and it's separate than this part here. There's actually a line here, right? The superiority complex means that they're superior because there's more here. Inferiority complex, there's less here, so they're inferior. The perception of it's all great and equal is the equality complex, right? They get their part, they get their part, everything's good. But there's still separation, right? There's still separation. There's still two selves, right? So the balance, when you think about balance, you think differently. Now you think of something that doesn't have separation. If you think of the hourglass, right? It's one container, it's one glass. You turn it upside down and now one side has more and the other side has less. But it's still one. It's just that one side happens to have more. It's unbalanced. You turn it to the other side, now the other side has more. The other one has less. Right? It's still one. It's still one, I'm still a part of this. It's just that at this moment, there's happens to be more on this side than on that side. So another way to think about it is, you always come back to the line graph and the emergency. So if you just look at this, it's, there's more and then there's less here, right? So we think of, again, superior is people who have more, because the superiority complex is based on power, right? And who has it's based on who has more power. Like when it comes right down to this, it's who's got the power. Like if you think of this country, why do we have white supremacy? It's because there is a white supremacist power structure that exists, right? There's a male power structure that exists. We all defer to male, right? Okay. So it is. It does come down often to how much power. So if you think about this as a superiority, more and less, right? The equality complex would be, okay, if you had more, you had equal as me, then it would be okay. We're equal. Everybody's happy, right? And we have this whole past perception, if you think in this country, around the separate and equal period, where it was okay to have segregation as long as everybody had equal amount. So that it's a very human complex, this separate and equal. Give everybody equal amounts, but separate them. That's what we did. Well, we didn't really do that, but that's what the policy said that we did. Put the black people over there, put the white people over there, give them the same amount of resources, and life is good. That's the equality complex. But do you see how easily you can see that it's still wrong? It's wrong because we're separating black people and white people. And why is that? It's because we still think that they're different from each other. This is the balance. This is where you can allow, you don't separate anymore according to black and white. This isn't really stagnant. It's going to go like this, actually. And that going like this is going to be when we err and we put too many resources in one community, like the white community, and not the black community. And I'm using black and white right now for ease of discussion, but I'm referring to any person of color community, any people of color community that we've under-resourced. So this moves like this. It's a flow. At one moment, there might be too many resources in one and the other, but it's always a flow. It's not this separate self. So we're not the base of our, the base of how we do it comes from a sense that like we're one, we're not separate. So this is a real, this, the quality and balance, sometimes it's a little bit difficult to grasp sometimes just because in as human beings, we don't think about, we only think about ourselves as separate from each other. And especially in the United States, which is a very individualistic country, and from the beginning, the teaching is that pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You are the only one that can do it. So this is so ingrained and embedded in America's psyche that to think that we are actually connected to the other person is almost like it's a shift. It's hard. It's so hard for us to grasp. So Tai gives a really good example, right? He says, when the left hand gets a cut, the right hand, it doesn't even think, it just moves to take care of it. There's not even like a thought. And why is that? Because it's one body. It's one body, it's interconnected, right? And it's like that, it's like, it's the oneness of us. So when we say, when we have this saying that, that could be me, it comes again from the idea that there's two bodies. Like what if the right hand saw the finger, the left finger bleeding and said, that could be my finger. Because I have one that looks just like that. I really lucked out this time. Glad I wasn't there. And goes over there and has a cup of tea. Right? But this is it right here, right? But that doesn't happen. There's not even there's no like process or thinking. There's just this base of interconnection that exists where when this finger starts to bleed, immediately the hand goes to stop it. There's no like thinking, there's no analysis, there's no like the last time when I bled, did you come over, lefty, and help me? Yeah, which is what we do, right? Yeah. It's not like that. It just goes. Like when we get a fly bite, think about it. The fly bites us, we just immediately start to soothe it. We don't think like, okay, I'm up here and you're all the way down there and I have to reach to you in order to soothe you. But it's like that. That's how simple it is. Is we are one big interconnected cosmos. But as we have moved through the world and as we continue to become a digital economy and a society, the digitalization can only happen in these kind of devices because it has already happened in us as human beings. Because it requires a mind that thinks in that separate digital way to come up with a construct and a technology to develop this. You only can do what you already understand and have experienced somehow, some way. And so we are a society that's built on separate. I mean, that's the policy of the United States of America, separate but equal. And so it's this continued embeddedness, the psyche that has developed itself over and over again that can come up with these things that we all think is amazing. I mean, I think it's pretty amazing, right? Like I'm talking and it's recording it and I can go back and listen. I can bring Tai's words right here on this computer and I don't have to carry many books. But there is a limit to what this is doing to us. And it comes from a psyche that has already been separated. And so it is for us to determine what is too much. And this is why I like balance. Because balance allows us to think about the whole and just keep thinking about, I think about the sand dunes when the wind blows. Over there might be a peak and then there's a wind and then it moves. There's another peak. There's a hill over here. And there's this constant moving of the sands with the wind. And that this is how we rethink balance. Is that if we are not aware, if we're not awake, if we are not mindful, if we're not waking up in every moment, if we're not heedful, if we're not watching how our foot touches the ground, how our breath comes in and out, how we're eating, we will go back into this very separate self and we won't be able to hold that at any one time without awareness, we will allow the balance to go off. And sometimes when the balance goes off too much, then there's real harm, right? Like climate change, right? Which is an example of how we have engaged with the climate that's part of us, and now it's completely shifted. So that's one of those dunes that's like really gotten really, really big, and we forgot to take care of it. And we have participated intricately and intimately. You know, every time we order food out and someone delivers it, we've participated. So we participate in every single thing we do, in every step we make, we've participated in it. Just like in everything we do, we participate in whether or not we're in maintaining this superiority and inferiority, power, non-power way of being and thinking. But the beautiful thing is that we can change all this. We can change it exteriorly as we do work of social change, and we can do it internally, which is really where it starts. Change starts inside. And if we want to be able to be in those spaces and not keep ourselves separate and not think I'm so lucky that I'm not that person, but because I'm not in that situation, I can do that work to help them. But we're still coming from the sense of separation. But if we take care of ourselves, we start to understand this interconnection, this inter-R, and we do that work, we're bringing a very different energy, and it's going to shift things. People understand and feel when it's different. Someone who's homeless knows when you give them money out of pity versus when you're giving them money because you know that they're just like you. It's different. And folks know it. And it doesn't mean it's not terrible to help someone who's homeless, even if you're coming from the separate self. But wouldn't it be nice to really support their humanity? And to really allow them to know that you know that you're the same. And just in this moment, because of all the conditions that's come to be, it happens that your left finger is there begging on the street under a blanket, and your right finger is here with money in your pocket to give them. Just because of the causes and conditions that have manifested. But just because they're separate, it doesn't mean that. With our practice, we talk about mindfulness, we talk about slow walking. Sometimes it seems like these like little things, like how's walking slow gonna do anything to change the world? How's following my breath gonna do anything? But we all know, because we're here, that in the midst of any difficulty, that if we can come back to the breath, everything shifts. One breath starts to shift. Two breaths bring us back. Three breaths, and we actually have some clarity. And what we do and say next is actually different than what we would have done or said had we not taken the time to have those three breaths, right? There's so many stories by so many different practitioners. Thich Nhat Hanh, for one, talking about when, in the midst of the war, no matter how difficult it was, how many deadlines, that if they didn't stop and breathe every night together, that they wouldn't have been able to do what they did the next day. That when they were helping the boat people, and everything was happening, and people, boats were capsizing, and 400 people would drown right in front of the eyes of others, this urgency to do was tampered by, we have to walk, we have to breathe, and then we can take care of that. And so this isn't just this little thing like, oh, it'll make me a better person. So we come together, we draw hearts on the wall, we take the time to remember what we're grateful for. We sing. When we sing together, we breathe together. And once we're breathing together, we are in community, because we're breathing as one body, one Sangha body. So we sing. We sing to gladden the mind. We gladden the mind so that we can have the spaciousness when we meet the difficulties. We have nourished ourselves, so when we meet hard things, we have spaciousness to take care of it. Because we've been singing, because we've been hanging out with friends that are nourishing us, because we've been smiling and laughing, because we've been talking to our plants and our pets, and they nourish us. So that when we go out and we meet the difficulty, or when there's a fight at home, we have the spaciousness to continue to practice and be kind in that moment. We don't forget our practice. So the practice is in every moment. And to be able to practice in the midst of the challenge and the chaos requires that we practice in places like this. We nourish the seed, we keep growing that little plant, so that when we're outside, the plant, it has leaves and flowers, it's blooming. But it's blooming because just like it started from the seed and it was watered, it had the time to grow to that blooming flower that was out, now is outside and is offering fragrance and beauty. But when you see the plant, when you don't see the seed, and you know sometimes you plant a seed and it, you know, there's like 3 weeks and there's nothing, and you're thinking like, hey, there's nothing there. I think practice is like that sometimes. Is you go to practice every week, you go to Sangha, you sit. Sometimes you're like, what's this about? It's like that. You keep going back to Sangha. You keep going back to sit and practice. However, whatever your Sangha, with your partner, with your children, with a community. But you keep going back to practice, because that seed, if it's nourished properly with the water and the sun and the care, it will bloom. So don't let the lack of the little seedling green things that come out the earth, and then you see it, and then you're like, ah. Oh. And it's like that too. Practice goes like that. Maybe there's like a month, 2 months, and you're like, what am I doing? And then something happens, and then you handle it differently, or you had this insight, or you were able to stop and breathe in a place where it was really difficult. And then you're like, ah, oh, yeah. So that's the flower blooming. That's the scent of the flower that you were able to capture. So we practice, we come together, we nourish ourselves. I say to people, you find a sangha, somehow you keep your practice going. Sit every day. If it's 10 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes at night, sit. There is an urgency for us to change this world, y'all. We don't have time to wait anymore. A lot of social activism has occurred that hasn't been mindful, that hasn't come from place of love, that has come from separation. So I feel an urgency. The president of this country is scaring me. I feel urgent. So now I say, go home and practice. Sit every day. I don't care if it's 5 minutes in the morning or 5 minutes at night, sit. Get your body used to being in that position where you're following your breath, you're closing out the sense doors, and you're actually coming home to your body and your mind. Sit. If you're sitting on a bus, if you're sitting in a car, sit. Don't just sit there and be a log. Sit and activate your mind and breathe. Gain insight. Practice in community so you're supported. When you get tired and you're not doing it at home, find a sangha. If there's not one near you, form one. Invite a friend over and sit together. Go to retreats. Retreats help re-nourish you. Weekend retreats like this, it's like you're in community and you're nourishing, and that little plant, that seed's growing a little bit bigger because you're getting a lot of sunlight and a lot of water and a lot of love. And then go back home and keep doing it. And then when you start feeling tired again and you're not practicing, find another retreat. But you gotta practice, because the world's going crazy. And if you're not doing anything, you're part of the problem. And doing something means transforming yourself. So notice I'm not saying to go out to a protest. I'm all about protests. But notice I'm not saying that. I'm saying take care of yourself and practice. And out of that insight, you'll know what to do better to change this world for a better place so that we can all be here happy.